Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, 2014 seems a long way off, but you already have a lot of people declaring whether or not they'll run for various offices, and that also includes folks who are running for re-election. And one of those is Arkansas Democrat Mark Pryor, who's already won two terms. He's relatively popular in the state, but he's got some issues from his last term that he's certainly going to answer for. And if Blanche Lincoln's results in 2010 are any indication, Mark Pryor could have a very tough race on his hands, particularly if the Republicans can field a decent candidate. And now, whoever that candidate is and the Republican Party have a lot of good ammunition. They've already got his voting record on stimulus, on Obamacare, as well as several other liberal items. But when the senator was being interviewed on local television, KARK, he was asked specifically about whether he thought voting for Obamacare back in 2010 was the right vote.
I think it was the right vote. I think it was good for Arkansas. In fact, you can look at what the Republican state legislature just did here a few weeks ago, and that is they voted to implement Obamacare here in Arkansas through the Medicaid expansion.
Well, they would argue, though, that they took lemons and made lemonade out of it.
What they did is they put the law into effect here in Arkansas. They did it in a different way with the governor's leadership and a lot of the medical community's leadership. Appreciate that. Different way, but they did follow Obamacare by expanding Medicaid in Arkansas.
Yeah, Democratic governor, by the way. And here's the real clincher.
There's no doubt we didn't get it all right. I can promise you, if we got 80% of it right, we did something. You know, we still need to go in and work on that 20%. And I've already supported efforts to change some of that. And I support efforts now. I support efforts in the past. I'll support efforts in the future to get it right.
If a vote were to come up in the U.S. Senate to repeal Obamacare, you'd be against it?
I'd be against it.
Jim, Blanche Lincoln got pummeled so badly for that vote that she wasn't even competitive for an incumbent. If Mark Pryor thinks this is a winning issue for him, I don't know what polls he's looking at.
Arkansas voters, I hope you enjoyed that soundbite because you're going to be hearing it a lot between now and November 2014. Now, the intriguing thing is that most – you saw towards the end that, we didn't get it all right. Pryor faces a tougher version of what most Democrats are going to face between now and 2014. It's this question of, look, you passed this bill that is a mess. So what do you do? And for some of them, it's going to be, you know, a couple of them tried to distance themselves back in 2010. In this year's midterms, most Democrats have allegedly decided, according to an article in Politico today, that Democrats are going to embrace Obamacare. They're going to bear hug it. They're going to say, yes, Obamacare is great and you're going to love it. Just you wait and see. Now, the problem is that this stops being something theoretical and it starts being something actual. And while there may be some parts of Obamacare that people like, the premium hikes are going to go into effect starting this year and next year. The part that I wrote a little bit about today on Campaign Spot is that starting next year, if you don't have insurance, you have to pay a fine, either $95 or 1% of your income. And moving up to 2016, that becomes a much higher fee, $695 or 2.5% of your income. Now, people say, well, yes, Jim, that's the whole point of the mandate is to make people get health insurance. And, you know, most people who look at the uninsured, the reason they weren't buying insurance wasn't because there wasn't a law making them. You know, it wasn't that somebody wasn't coming along and beating them with a stick until they do the right thing. For a lot of people, it was tough affording them. But the other thing is that people found it all very complicated and confusing, and they felt like they weren't going to get their money's worth. And, we're talking about people who just are disinclined to do things like purchasing health insurance. And so the question is, are we really a better society if the government comes in and, you know, we're going to fine you. You are a lawbreaker if you don't have health insurance. Again, this is a tough circumstance for a Democrat to run for re-election. Don't worry, we're finally punishing the uninsured the way they've always deserved. And the idea that Pryor is going to, you know, be able to square that circle is an exceptionally tough line to swallow. And so he's going to have to, you know, basically say, look, I voted for this and I'm proud of it and it was the right call, which he does in the early part of that, or he's going to have to have a conversion on the road to Damascus, so to speak, and he's going to say, oh, actually, no, I don't like it. I think his bed has been made, and he is an Obamacare defender. And as far as Republicans in Arkansas are going to be concerned, Obamacare will be on the ballot in November 2014. And that's a tough outlook for Pryor, but you vote for a bill like that, you're going to eventually pay the price for it. And my guess is that, you know, some lucky Republican in Arkansas will end up being the beneficiary of that.
Yeah, let's hope the party can recruit a solid candidate who can win that seat, because Pryor's got a lot to answer for. That's just the tip of the iceberg. He's been a pretty reliable Democratic vote, and only recently, when it came to background checks and so forth, when he saw the next election on the horizon, did he start to actually remember who he represented. But we'll see how big of a price he pays for that. On to Martini number two now, Jim. And the Obama administration either has a strange habit or just doesn't really know how to protect other people's secrets. I guess we have issues with our own, since a lot of classified information on the Bin Laden raid got out too. But Leon Panetta talked on the record, when he shouldn't have, about the potential timetable for an Israeli military strike on the Iranian nuclear facilities. Then somehow the U.S. revealed that Israel was thinking about perhaps using bases in Azerbaijan for strategic purposes if they ended up attacking Iran. That wasn't supposed to get public. Now there's more. This is from McClatchy. Israel's military fumed Monday over the discovery that the U.S. had revealed details of a top-secret Israeli military installation in published bid requests. The Obama administration had promised to build Israel a state-of-the-art facility to house a new ballistic missile defense system, the Arrow 3. As with all Defense Department projects, detailed specifications were made public so that contractors could bid on the $25 million project. The specifications included more than 1,000 pages of details on the facility, ranging from the heating and cooling systems to the thickness of the walls. Quote, if an enemy of Israel wanted to launch an attack against a facility, this would give him an easy how-to guide. This type of information is closely guarded, and its release can jeopardize the entire facility, said an Israeli military official who commented on the publication of the proposal. He calls this more worrying than shocking, but Jim, it's not the first time this has happened, and I'm not sure how you bid this out without giving more details, but is clearly not very responsible on the part of the Obama administration.
Yeah, it's unnerving that this is now a pattern of behavior. It's kind of amazing the Israelis tell us anything anymore. I suppose that a lot of these types of laws get set up with a good idea in mind of, well, we want to have accountability and we want to have, you know, competition for contracts and stuff like that. If I were an enemy spy, this would be the first place I would be looking. And in fact, I've heard about this not too long ago, that apparently there's a warehouse complex run by the Government Services Administration in Springfield, Virginia. And basically this warehouse complex is used for storage. And apparently on some document back in the early 1990s, they listed the eight agencies that are, you know, keep their documents in this warehouse complex, including the Central Intelligence Agency, which is obviously meant to remain secret. So if you were a bad person, when you wanted to know a whole bunch of your CIA secrets, you know exactly which warehouse complex in Springfield you need to break into, all because somebody wasn't paying attention. So whether this is an innocent mistake or whether this is a form of the administration kind of sending a little signal to Israel or just kind of, you know, basically trolling them, whatever the motive, it's a bad sign, and you're not surprised in the context of a already complicated and tense U.S.-Israeli relationship. Stuff like this just kind of further erodes your faith in the administration's ability to do the job it's supposed to do.
Very disappointing. And if you're the Israelis, who are obviously concerned about issues from a number of fronts, Iran, Syria, Egypt, and increasingly, this is certainly not the type of help you want from your most trusted ally. On to Martini number three now, Jim. And, you know, continuing education is an important thing, particularly for those who don't have a lot of education in the first place. I think American taxpayers might be a little bit surprised, though, about how much of that continuing education is being provided for the 166 terrorist detainees at Guantanamo Bay. This from CNSNews.com. The detainees are offered a course in interviewing and resume writing as part of their indefinite stay at the prison camp. Joint Task Force Guantanamo lists the variety of classes and activities it offers to the terrorist trainers, financiers, bomb makers, recruiters, and facilitators who are housed at Gitmo. Among them, interviewing and resume writing and writing success. Jim, I think the hardest problem here, if these folks ever get out and try to get a job, is what's with this 12-year gap in your resume?
I was trying to imagine, how do these resume writing classes go? And what does a terrorist resume look like? You know, well, before the recession, but this is my terrorist voice. You know, I'm sure CARE or somebody, you know, CARE will probably send a furious letter denouncing my accent, but pointing out that it sounds a little bit more like Boris Badenov or somebody from Rocky and Bullwinkle. You know. Fearless leader, no. So back before the recession, my business was booming. I had explosive growth in selling dynamite vests. Or the other possibility that kind of comes to mind is this: when they talk about writing skills, is this for when you issue your YouTube threatening videos and statements like that? that, you know, remember to use active verbs. You know, it is I will destroy you, not I am going to destroy you. He's kind of, you know, I'm kind of curious about grammar and clarity and things like that. Who gets that job of editing the terrorists? I suppose this is a mentality of, you know, well, we want to rehabilitate these people. We want to give them jobs to go back to besides being a terrorist. Maybe I've become a cynic, but I just kind of feel like once you've had the thrill of blowing people up, I just kind of wonder if, like, you know, oh, now I run a suit store, or I run a restaurant or a cafe. I import tea now. I just have a hard time believing these guys are really going to be all that happy with the former Muslim extremist version of Levittown and being the man in the gray flannel suit. These guys have already been the man and the guys in the, you know, C4 vest and, you know, explosive underwear and stuff like that. So it just seems like a bizarre set of circumstances. And resume writing for terrorists just seems like something that'd come out of a Chris Buckley novel or something like that. Just utterly bizarre and cannot possibly represent money well spent, I would suggest.
He's Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.